when his money was gone, and he was once more borrowing and begging everywhere with a meanness worthy of his nature. He got into a difficulty with the Pope respecting the crown of Sicily, which the Pope said he had a right to give away, and which he offered to King Henry for his second son, Prince Edmund. But, if you or I give away what we have not got, and what belongs to somebody else, it is likely that the person to whom we give it, will have some trouble in taking it. It was exactly so in this case. It was necessary to conquer the Sicilian crown before it could be put upon young Edmund at TMS head. It could not be conquered without money. The Pope ordered the clergy to raise money. The clergy, however, were not so obedient to him as usual. They had been disputing with him for some time about his unjust preference of Italian priests in England, and they had begun to doubt whether the King of TMS chaplain, whom he allowed to be paid for preaching in 700 churches, could possibly be, even by the Pope TMS favour, in 700 places at once. At the Pope and the King together, ATM said the Bishop of London, "A may take the mitre off my head, but, if they do, they will find that I shall put on a soldier a TMS helmet. I pay nothing." ATM The Bishop of Worcester was as bold as the Bishop of London, and would pay nothing either. Such sums as the more timid or more helpless of the clergy did raise were squandered away, without doing any good to the king, or bringing the Sicilian crown an inch nearer to Prince Edmund at TMS head. The end of the business was, that the Pope gave the crown to the brother of the King of France, who conquered it for himself, and sent the King of England in a bill of £100,000 for the expenses of not having won it. The king was now so much distressed that we might almost pity him, if it were possible to pity a king so shabby and ridiculous. His clever brother, Richard, had bought the title of King of the Romans from the German people, and was no longer near him, to help him with advice. The clergy, resisting the very Pope, were in alliance with the barons. The barons were headed by Simon de Montfort, Earl of Leicester, married to King Henrietta's sister, and, though a foreigner himself, the most popular man in England against the foreign favourites. When the king next met his parliament, the barons, led by this earl, came before him, armed from head to foot, and cased in armour. When the parliament again assembled, in a month at TMS time, at Oxford, this earl was at their head, and the king was obliged to consent, on oath, to what was called a committee of government, consisting of 24 members. 12 chosen by the barons, and 12 chosen by himself. But, at a good time for him, his brother Richard came back. Richard at TMS first act, the barons would not admit him into England on other terms, was to swear to be faithful to the committee of government, which he immediately began to oppose with all his might. Then, the barons began to quarrel among themselves, especially the proud Earl of Gloucester with the Earl of Leicester, who went abroad in disgust. Then, the people began to be dissatisfied with the barons, because they did not do enough for them. The King of TMS chances seemed so good again at length, that he took heart in or Ufa or caught it from his brother to tell the committee of government that he abolished Thimu as to his oath. "Never mind that," the Pope said. "A and to seize all the money in the mint, and to shut himself up in the Tower of London." Here he was joined by his eldest son, Prince Edward, and, from the tower, he made public a letter of the Pope TMS to the world in general, informing all men that he had been an excellent and just king for 45 years. As everybody knew he had been nothing of the sort, nobody cared much for this document. It so chanced that the proud Earl of Gloucester dying, was succeeded by his son, and that his son, instead of being the enemy of the Earl of Leicester, was, for the time, his friend. It fell out, therefore, that these two earls joined their forces, took several of the royal castles in the country, and advanced as hard as they could on London. The London people, always opposed to the king, declared for them with great joy. The king himself remained shut up, not at all gloriously, in the tower. Prince Edward made the best of his way to Windsor Castle. His mother, the queen, attempted to follow him by water, but, the people seeing her barge rowing up the river, and hating her with all their hearts, ran to London Bridge, got together a quantity of stones and mud, and pelted the barge as it came through, crying furiously, "A, drown the witch. Drown her. ATM." They were so near doing it, that the mayor took the old lady under his protection, and shut her up in St. Paul at TMS until the danger was past. "It would require a great deal of writing on my part, and a great deal of reading on yours, to follow the king through his disputes with the barons, and to follow the barons through their disputes with one another, so I will make short work of it for both of us, and only relate the chief events that rose out of these quarrels. The good king of France was asked to decide between them. He gave it as his opinion that the king must maintain the Great Charter, and that the barons must give up the Committee of Government, and all the rest that had been done by the Parliament at Oxford, which the Royalists, or King O'TMS party, scornfully called the Mad Parliament. The barons declared that these were not fair terms, and they would not accept them. Then they caused the great bell of St. Paul O'TMS to be tolled, for the purpose of rousing up the London people, who armed themselves at the dismal sound and formed quite an army in the streets. I am sorry to say, however, that instead of falling upon the King O'TMS party with whom their quarrel was, they fell upon the miserable Jews, and killed at least 500 of them. They pretended that some of these Jews were on the King O'TMS side, and that they kept hidden in their houses, for the destruction of the people, a certain terrible composition called Greek fire, which could not be put out with water, but only burnt the fiercer for it. What they really did keep in their houses was money, and this their cruel enemies wanted, and this their cruel enemies took, like robbers and murderers. The Earl of Leicester put himself at the head of these Londoners and other forces, and followed the king to Lewes in Sussex, where he lay encamped with his army. Before giving the king O'TMS forces battle here, the Earl addressed his soldiers, and said that King Henry III had broken so many oaths, that he had become the enemy of God, and therefore they would wear white crosses on their breasts, as if they were arrayed, not against a fellow Christian, but against a Turk. White-crossed accordingly, they rushed into the fight. They would have lost the dire, the king having on his side all the foreigners in England, and, from Scotland, John Comyn, John Balliol, and Robert Bruce, with all their men, but for the impatience of Prince Edward, who, in his hot desire to have vengeance on the people of London, threw the whole of his father at TMS army into confusion. He was taken prisoner, so was the king. So was the king at TMS brother, the king of the Romans, and 5,000 Englishmen were left dead upon the bloody grass. For this success, the Pope excommunicated the Earl of Leicester, which neither the Earl nor the people cared at all about. The people loved him and supported him, and he became the real king, having all the power of the government in his own hands, though he was outwardly respectful to King Henry III, whom he took with him wherever he went, like a poor old imp court card. He summoned a parliament, in the year 1265, which was the first parliament in England that the people had any real share in electing, and he grew more and more in favour with the people every day, and they stood by him in whatever he did. Many of the other barons, and particularly the Earl of Gloucester, who had become by this time as proud as his father, grew jealous of this powerful and popular earl, who was proud too, and began to conspire against him. Since the Battle of Lewes, Prince Edward had been kept as a hostage, and, though he was otherwise treated like a prince, had never been allowed to go out without attendants appointed by the Earl of Leicester, who watched him. The conspiring lords found means to propose to him, in secret, that they should assist him to escape, and should make him their leader, to which he very heartily consented. So, on a day that was agreed upon, he said to his attendants after dinner, being then at Hereford, "I should like to ride on horseback, this fine afternoon, a little way into the country. ATM as they, too, thought it would be very pleasant to have a canter in the sunshine, they all rode out of the town together in a gay little troop. When they came to a fine level piece of turf, the prince fell to comparing their horses one with another, and offering bets that one was faster than another, and the attendants, suspecting no harm, rode galloping matches until their horses were quite tired. The prince rode no matches himself, but looked on from his saddle, and staked his money. Thus they passed the whole merry afternoon. Now, The sun was setting, and they were all going slowly up a hill, the Princeteer mess horse very fresh and all the other horses very weary, when a strange rider mounted on a grey steed appeared at the top of the hill, and waved his hat. "Eh, what does the fellow mean?" "ATM," said the attendants one to another. The prince answered on the instant by setting spurs to his horse, dashing away at his utmost speed, joining the man, riding into the midst of a little crowd of horsemen who were then seen waiting under some trees, and who closed around him, and so he departed in a cloud of dust, leaving the road empty of all but the baffled attendants, who sat looking at one another, while their horses drooped their ears and panted. The prince joined the Earl of Gloucester at Ludlow. The Earl of Leicester, with a part of the army and the stupid old king, was at Hereford. One of the Earl of Leicester at EMS sons, Simon de Montfort, with another part of the army, was in Sussex. To prevent these two parts from uniting was the Princeteer's first object. He attacked Simon de Montfort by night, defeated him, seized his banners and treasure, and forced him into Kenilworth Castle in Warwickshire, which belonged to his family. His father, the Earl of Leicester, in the meanwhile, not knowing what had happened, marched out of Hereford, with his part of the army and the king, to meet him. He came, on a bright morning in August, to Evesham, which is watered by the pleasant River Avon. Looking rather anxiously across the prospect towards Kenilworth, he saw his own banners advancing, and his face brightened with joy. But, it clouded darkly when he presently perceived that the banners were captured, and in the enemy at EMS hands, and he said, "It is over. The Lord have mercy on our souls, for our bodies are Prince Edward at EMS. ATM, he fought like a true knight, nevertheless. When his horse was killed under him, he fought on foot. It was a fierce battle, and the dead lay in heaps everywhere. The old king, stuck up in a suit of armor on a big war horse, which did not EMT mind him at all, and which carried him into all sorts of places where he did not EMT want to go, got into everybody at EMS way, and very nearly got knocked on the head by one of his son at EMS men. But he managed to pipe out, "Eh, I am Harry of Winchester." ATM and the prince, who heard him, seized his bridle, and took him out of peril. The Earl of Leicester still fought bravely, until his best son Henry was killed, and the bodies of his best friends choked his path, and then he fell, still fighting, sword in hand. They mangled his body, and sent it as a present to a noble lady, but a very unpleasant lady, I should think, who was the wife of his worst enemy. They could not mangle his memory in the minds of the faithful people, though. Many years afterwards, they loved him more than ever, and regarded him as a saint, and always spoke of him as a Sir Simon the Righteous. ATM, and even though he was dead, the cause for which he had fought still lived, and was strong, and forced itself upon the king in the very hour of victory. Henry found himself obliged to respect the Great Charter, however much he hated it, and to make laws similar to the laws of the great Earl of Leicester, and to be moderate and forgiving towards the people at last, to even towards the people of London, who had so long opposed him. There were more risings before all this was done, but they were set at rest by these means, and Prince Edward did his best in all things to restore peace. One Sir Adam de Gordon was the last dissatisfied knight in arms, but the prince vanquished him in single combat, in a wood, and nobly gave him his life, and became his friend, instead of slaying him. Sir Adam was not ungrateful. He ever afterwards remained devoted to his generous conqueror. When the troubles of the kingdom were thus calmed, Prince Edward and his cousin Henry took the cross, and went away to the Holy Land, with many English lords and knights. 4 years afterwards the King of the Romans died, and, next year, 1272, his brother the weak King of England died. He was 68 years old then, and had reigned 56 years. He was as much of a king in death, as he had ever been in life. He was the mere pale shadow of a king at all times. Chapter 6 View England under Edward I, called Longshanks. It was now the year of our Lord 1272, and Prince Edward, the heir to the throne, being away in the Holy Land, knew nothing of his father Etiam's death. The barons, however, proclaimed him king, immediately after the royal funeral, and the people very willingly consented, since most men knew too well by this time what the horrors of a contest for the crown were. So King Edward I, called, in a not very complimentary manner, Longshanks, because of the slenderness of his legs, was peacefully accepted by the English nation. His legs had need to be strong, however long and thin they were, for they had to support him through many difficulties on the fiery sands of Asia, where his small force of soldiers fainted, died, deserted, and seemed to melt away. But his prowess made light of it, and he said, "I will go on, if I go on with no other follower than my groom." Etiam, a prince of this spirit, gave the Turks a deal of trouble. He stormed Nazareth, at which place, of all places on earth, I am sorry to relate, he made a frightful slaughter of innocent people, and then he went to Acre, where he got a truce of 10 years from the Sultan. He had very nearly lost his life in Acre, through the treachery of a Saracen noble, called the Emir of Jaffa, who, making the pretense that he had some idea of turning Christian and wanted to know all about that religion, sent a trusty messenger to Edward very often with a dagger in his sleeve. At last, one Friday in Whitsun week, when it was very hot, and all the sandy prospect lay beneath the blazing sun, burnt up like a great overdone biscuit, and Edward was lying on a couch, dressed for coolness in only a loose robe, the messenger, with his chocolate-colored face and his bright dark eyes and white teeth, came creeping in with a letter, and kneeled down like a tame tiger. But, the moment Edward stretched out his hand to take the letter, the tiger made a spring at his heart. He was quick. But Edward was quick too. He seized the traitor by his chocolate throat, threw him to the ground, and slew him with the very dagger he had drawn. The weapon had struck Edward in the arm, and although the wound itself was slight, it threatened to be mortal, for the blade of the dagger had been smeared with poison. Thanks, however, to a better surgeon than was often to be found in those times, and to some wholesome herbs, and above all, to his faithful wife, Eleanor, who devotedly nursed him, and is said by some to have sucked the poison from the wound with her own red lips, which I am very willing to believe, Edward soon recovered and was sound again. As the king his father had sent entreaties to him to return home, he now began the journey. He had got as far as Italy, when he met messengers who brought him intelligence of the king Etiam's death. Hearing that all was quiet at home, he made no haste to return to his own dominions, but paid a visit to the Pope, and went in state through various Italian towns, where he was welcomed with acclamations as a mighty champion of the cross from the Holy Land, and where he received presents of purple mantles and prancing horses, and went along in great triumph. The shouting people little knew that he was the last English monarch who would ever embark in a crusade, or that within 20 years every conquest which the Christians had made in the Holy Land at the cost of so much blood, would be won back by the Turks. But all this came to pass. There was, and there is, an old town standing in a plain in France, called Chalons. When the king was coming towards this place on his way to England, a wily French lord, called the Count of Chalons, sent him a polite challenge to come with his knights and hold a fair tournament with the count and his knights, and make a day of it with sword and lance. It was represented to the king that the Count of Chalons was not to be trusted, and that, instead of a holiday fight for mere show and in good humour, he secretly meant a real battle, in which the English should be defeated by superior force. The king, however, nothing afraid, went to the appointed place on the appointed day with 1,000 followers. When the count came with 2,000 and attacked the English in earnest, the English rushed at them with such valor that the Counter TMS men and the Counter TMS horses soon began to be tumbled down all over the field. The count himself seized the king round the neck, but the king tumbled him out of his saddle in return for the compliment, and, jumping from his own horse, and standing over him, beat away at his iron armor like a blacksmith hammering on his anvil. Even when the count owned himself defeated and offered his sword, The king would not do him the honor to take it, but made him yield it up to a common soldier. There had been such fury shown in this fight, that it was afterwards called the Little Battle of Chalons. The English were very well disposed to be proud of their king after these adventures, so, when he landed at Dover in the year 1274, being then 36 years old, and went on to Westminster where he and his good queen were crowned with great magnificence, splendid rejoicings took place. For the coronation feast there were provided, among other eatables, 400 oxen, 400 sheep, 450 pigs, 18 wild boars, 300 flitches of bacon, and 20,000 fowls. The fountains and conduits in the street flowed with red and white wine instead of water. The rich citizens hung silks and cloths of the brightest colors out of their windows to increase the beauty of the show, and threw out gold and silver by whole handfuls to make scrambles for the crowd. In short, there was such eating and drinking, such music and capering, such a ringing of bells and tossing of caps, such a shouting, and singing, and reveling, as the narrow overhanging streets of old London City had not witnessed for many a long day. All the people were merry except the poor Jews, who, trembling within their houses, and scarcely daring to peep out, began to foresee that they would have to find the money for this joviality sooner or later. To dismiss this sad subject of the Jews for the present, I am sorry to add that in this reign they were most unmercifully pillaged. They were hanged in great numbers, on accusations of having clipped the king at Iamescoyna, which all kinds of people had done. They were heavily taxed, they were disgracefully badged, they were, on one day, 13 years after the coronation, taken up with their wives and children and thrown into beastly prisons, until they purchased their release by paying to the king £12,000. Finally, every kind of property belonging to them was seized by the king, except so little as would defray the charge of their taking themselves away into foreign countries. Many years elapsed before the hope of gain induced any of their race to return to England, where they had been treated so heartlessly and had suffered so much. If King Edward I had been as bad a king to Christians as he was to Jews, he would have been bad indeed. But he was, in general, a wise and great monarch, under whom the country much improved. He had no love for the Great Charter a few kings had, through many, many years, but he had high qualities. The first bold object which he conceived when he came home, was, to unite under one sovereign England, Scotland, and Wales, the two last of which countries had each a little king of its own, about whom the people were always quarrelling and fighting, and making a prodigious disturbance a great deal more than he was worth. In the course of King Edward at Iamescoyna's reign he was engaged, besides, in a war with France. To make these quarrels clearer, we will separate their histories and take them thus. Wales, first. France, second. Scotland, third. Llewellyn was the Prince of Wales. He had been on the side of the barons in the reign of the stupid old king, but had afterwards sworn allegiance to him. When King Edward came to the throne, Llewellyn was required to swear allegiance to him also, which he refused to do. The king, being crowned and in his own dominions, three times more required Llewellyn to come and do homage, and three times more Llewellyn said he would rather not. He was going to be married to Eleanor de Montfort, a young lady of the family mentioned in the last train, and it chanced that this young lady, coming from France with her youngest brother, Emeric, was taken by an English ship, and was ordered by the English king to be detained. Upon this, the quarrel came to a head. The king went, with his fleet, to the coast of Wales, where, so encompassing Llewellyn, that he could only take refuge in the bleak mountain region of Snowdon in which no provisions could reach him, he was soon starved into an apology, and into a treaty of peace, and into paying the expenses of the war. The king, however, forgave him some of the hardest conditions of the treaty, and consented to his marriage. And he now thought he had reduced Wales to obedience. But the Welsh, although they were naturally a gentle, quiet, pleasant people, who liked to receive strangers in their cottages among the mountains, and to set before them with free hospitality whatever they had to eat and drink, and to play to them on their harps, and sing their native ballads to them, were a people of great spirit when their blood was up. Englishmen, after this affair, began to be insolent in Wales, and to assume the air of masters, and the Welsh pride could not bear it. Moreover, they believed in that unlucky old Merlin, some of whose unlucky old prophecies somebody always seemed doomed to remember when there was a chance of its doing harm, and just at this time some blind old gentleman with a harp and a long white beard, who was an excellent person, but had become of an unknown age and tedious, burst out with a declaration that Merlin had predicted that when English money had become round, a Prince of Wales would be crowned in London. Now, King Edward had recently forbidden the English penny to be cut into halves and quarters for halfpence and farthings, and had actually introduced a round coin. Therefore, the Welsh people said this was the time Merlin meant, and rose accordingly. King Edward had bought over Prince David, Lelinetiam's brother, by heaping favours upon him, but he was the first to revolt, being perhaps troubled in his conscience. One stormy night, he surprised the castle of Hawarden, in possession of which an English nobleman had been left, killed the whole garrison, and carried off the nobleman a prisoner to Snowdon. Upon this, the Welsh people rose like one man. King Edward, with his army, marching from Worcester to the Menai Strait, crossed it on near to where the wonderful tubular iron bridge now, in days so different, makes a passage for railway trains by a bridge of boats that enabled 40 men to march abreast. He subdued the island of Anglesey, and sent his men forward to observe the enemy. The sudden appearance of the Welsh created a panic among them, and they fell back to the bridge. The tide had in the meantime risen and separated the boats. The Welsh pursuing them, they were driven into the sea, and there they sunk, in their heavy iron armour, by thousands. After this victory Llewellyn, helped by the severe winter weather of Wales, gained another battle, but the king ordering a portion of his English army to advance through South Wales, and catch him between two foes, and Llewellyn bravely turning to meet this new enemy, he was surprised and killed very meanly, for he was unarmed and defenceless. His head was struck off and sent to London, where it was fixed upon the tower, encircled with a wreath, some say of ivy, some say of willow, some say of silver, to make it look like a ghastly coin in ridicule of the prediction. David, however, still held out for 6 months, though eagerly sought after by the king, and hunted by his own countrymen. One of them finally betrayed him with his wife and children. He was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. And from that time this became the established punishment of traitors in England, a punishment wholly without excuse, as being revolting, vile, and cruel, after its object is dead, and which has no sense in it, as its only real degradation, and that nothing can blot out, is to the country that permits on any consideration such abominable barbarity. Wales was now subdued. The Queen giving birth to a young prince in the castle of Carnarvon, the king showed him to the Welsh people as their countryman, and called him Prince of Wales, a title that has ever since been borne by the heir apparent to the English throne, which that little prince soon became, by the death of his elder brother. The king did better things for the Welsh than that, by improving their laws and encouraging their trade. Disturbances still took place, chiefly occasioned by the avarice and pride of the English lords, on whom Welsh lands and castles had been bestowed, but they were subdued, and the country never rose again. There is a legend that, to prevent the people from being incited to rebellion by the songs of their bards and harpers, Edward had them all put to death. Some of them may have fallen among other men who held out against the king, but this general slaughter is, I think, a fancy of the harpers themselves, who, I dare say, made a song about it many years afterwards, and sang it by the Welsh firesides until it came to be believed. The foreign war of the reign of Edward I arose in this way: the crews of two vessels, one a Norman ship, and the other an English ship, happened to go to the same place in their boats to fill their casks with fresh water. Being rough angry fellows, they began to quarrel, and then to fight the English with their fists, the Normans with their knives, and, in the fight, a Norman was killed. The Norman crew, instead of revenging themselves upon those English sailors with whom they had quarreled, who were too strong for them, I suspect, took to their ship again in a great rage, attacked the first English ship they met, laid hold of an unoffending merchant who happened to be on board, and brutally hanged him in the rigging of their own vessel with a dog at his feet.